This is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Monday, November 23rd, 2015, and this is show number 550. I sure hope you got the memo that I moved the show out a day. And the live chat room is looking pretty small today because whenever I move it, it wrecks everybody's schedule. But we have the diehards of Jamal and John and Steve in there to keep us company for this off day. Well, on Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart will be back with a rather short installment of his series Programming by Stealth, this time taking a look at inline elements for HTML. Remember that if you want to listen to Chit Chat Across the Pond, you have to go subscribe separately, either on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, simply by searching for it. I also put together a little table to show how to subscribe to all three podcasts, the NoSilicast, Chit Chat Across the Pond, and Taming the Terminal, at a link in the menu bar over at podfeet.com. It is cleverly named Subscribe to the Shows. Anyway, I also put a link in the show notes for this week's episode. That should help you out if you get lost. It also does include links to the RSS feed if you want to put it in manually and how to find them in Stitcher Radio. So, I did mention that Chit Chat Across the Pond was rather short, and that's because Bart is still in the habit of keeping Chit Chats short if he has a longer security light, except they're not all in the same show anymore. But that does mean that we have a big security light this week. He explains the intricacies of what happened in the Mac App Store that caused people to get the messages that their apps were corrupted and needed to be reinstalled. It's pretty interesting stuff, along with the usual security tomfoolery. This weekend, longtime NoSilicast away Klaus Wolf from Germany flew from his home in Frankfurt to the United States for a short vacation. He wrote to us a while back to tell us he'd be passing briefly through Los Angeles and wondered if we could get together. We talked about everything we thought he might want to see in the area, but he told us he really wanted to do a hike and it looked like there was a nice one up to the Hollywood sign. Well, that sounded great to us for a bunch of reasons. First of all, we really like to hike. Second of all, Tesla could go with us, which would be fun. Third, we'd get to see Klaus. And finally, even though we've lived in LA, or the LA area at least, for over 40 years, we had never hiked to the Hollywood sign. Well, Klaus happened to arrive in LA for possibly one of the most spectacular weather weekends of all time. And I mean, this is from a place that has pretty nice weather all the time. But this weekend, it was really, really warm for November. Even for us, this was really warm. It was 81 degrees Fahrenheit, also known as 27 degrees centigrade. And I do not think either Steve or I have ever seen the skies more clear than they were the day we went on our hike. I'm not telling you all of this just to tell you what a terrific guy Klaus is, although he is funny, brilliant, clever, fun to argue with, and even laughs at my jokes. While we were on our hike, we got into a conversation about the NoSilicast community and how much it means to all of us. He suggested that part of the reason it thrives in its current form is because I do open myself up to you guys, telling you about Steve and Lindsay and Kyle and our dog Tesla, the Pod Mom, and many other joys in my life. When I started the podcast, I never pictured that sharing my personal life would help you to connect with me. Because I do talk about my real life, I find that the NoSilla castaways feel comfortable doing the same. In the live chat room and over at our Google Plus community at podfeet.com/Google Plus, people share their triumphs and tribulations. Kirshen tells us when her sweetie has a bike race. Rose tells us about the best Chardonnay to be found in Tasmania. Jim Sewell recently asked us for help in finding a tech solution to help watch over his elderly mother and allow her to stay at home with him. George from Tulsa shares pictures of his cat, Claws of Satan. Mark Pauly lets us have a peek at his wonderful grandson and now his new granddaughter. Stephen Getz shows us his world through photography. Alistair shares his walk along the Wellington Harbor. Kevin Alder shares his beautiful children with us and tells us how much he hates the hot weather. We talk about sports scores and what we're making for dinner and how much we love our geek gear. Because of these connections, Steve and I have gotten to meet people in person from Germany, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Belgium, England, Switzerland, Turkey, and even the United States. And that doesn't even include the people we consider dear friends that we just haven't met yet in physical space. I could go on and on about all of the lives we've been able to touch together because we know that the NoSilla castaways are a very welcoming bunch. I don't take this for granted at all. You've been with me during my mother's last years, virtually holding my hand during some of the harder days and sharing in our joys as well. As a fellow NoSilla castaway, I'd like to say that we have something unique here, and I thought, what better time to say how much I appreciate all of you than during the Thanksgiving week? I guess I'm just trying to say, I love you, man. I was born with a really well-developed left brain, the side associated with logic. Science and math came easily to me, and it was natural that I went into engineering as a result. My three brothers were also reasonably bright boys, but they were gifted with artsy-fartsy skills, you know, the side associated with a well-developed right brain. My oldest brother is a musician who also reads books on string theory, if you can picture that. Alas, I was the only one not musically inclined, even though I played flute and piccolo for 6 years. I was not inclined. I had zero artistic talent. However, like many of you out there, I always wished I could draw and paint. When Apple announced the iPad Pro and the pencil, I wondered whether I could become an artist. If I just had the right technology, talent would certainly exist in me, right? Well, I'm being silly, of course, but sometimes tools that remove friction can help us become more creative. Let's see if we can walk through a scenario to test this hypothesis. I went on a walk with our dog Tesla in a local park, and she paused at the top of a hill with this very regal look about her. I pulled out my iPhone and I got down low to compose a photograph so she was framed really beautifully against the sky. She looked fabulous with her golden fur in the late afternoon sun and her bright eyes up against this dusky afternoon sky. When I got home and looked at the photo, it was unremarkable. The camera sensor didn't have the dynamic range of my eyes, so Tesla was almost a silhouette in the photo instead of what I remembered. As you know, I've been working with MacFun's plugins and standalone applications for photos, and I'm really impressed with them. Several of the apps support layers and masking so that you can apply effects to just certain portions of the images. In order to apply the mask, you use two selection tools, the brush and the eraser. Using a trackpad or a mouse works tolerably well, but it's easy to get a glow around the edges of objects because you just can't select regions precisely enough. The Apple Pencil would allow us to select areas precisely, but my precious MacFun tools and other extensions are not available on the iPad. There must be a way to bring these technologies together. I want to use my iPad and my pencil, but my apps are over on my Mac. Well, I brought this up to Mark Pauly, also known as TLI_Mark for Twin Lakes Images, and he told us about an app called AstroPad that's designed to make your iPad, iPhone, or iPad Pro into a graphics tablet for your Mac. Wire to wireless, AstroPad mirrors your display and has support for the Apple Pencil. This might be just what I need. There are two apps to download, one for the Mac and one for the iPad. The Mac version is free, while the iPad version is $20 in the App Store. Now, that's pretty steep, but if you add up the cost of the Mac, the iPad, and the photo editing software, $20 really isn't that much, if it can do what we want. I bought AstroPad before I got the Apple Pencil or the iPad Pro, simply on Mark's suggestion. Here's a little hint. Never tell me to buy some, because it's your fault if I don't like it. Well, I tested it on my iPad Air 1 with my 12-inch MacBook and with a noiseless plug-in from MacFun. Now, I may have picked the hardest possible combination for AstroPad to excel. I started with a laptop that, while very, very new, is not the most powerful machine. Then I added in a 2-year-old iPad with an A7 processor. And then the meanest thing I did was I selected Noiseless as the application on which to test this setup. Let me explain exactly why Noiseless makes it harder. Noiseless, as the name implies, removes noise. The graphical interface is really cool. It lets you view your image with and without the noise reduction shown on either side of an orange line. If you slide the line back and forth, it updates real-time or near real-time, repainting both sides of the screen. If you can also leave the line still and slide the photo around with respect to the line to check out different areas of the photo, and you can zoom in and out. If it's a huge photo on a slower machine, it sometimes shows you a little progress bar going across before it finishes the repaint. Now think what we're asking AstroPad to do. It's constantly repainting the screen from the Mac to the iPad too, every time we're doing any of this, moving this line around. The result is that you can see the refresh rate of the screen on the iPad, which really bothered me at first. AstroPad is considered one of the best apps out there for how little lag it has, but this isn't technically lag. This is the refresh rate of the screen. Lag is when your finger moves on screen, but you don't see it get updated by the movement of your finger. When I got my smoking fast iPad Pro with the A9 processor, I hooked it up to my 2014 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro with gobs of RAM and dedicated graphics card. Now, I'm figuring this is the best possible scenario, right? Nope, the lag was pretty much unchanged. Yet again, the poor misunderstood MacBook is accused of being slow when it was not the cause at all. Another bit of trouble I had with AstroPad was how to size how much of the screen on the Mac was reflected onto the iPad Pro. On the Mac, you get a dotted rectangle that you can resize, but it's nearly impossible to make it the right size for the iPad. Because let's say on my Mac, I've got a 27-inch screen. I'm trying to size this rectangle to be the size in pixels of what I'm going to go see on the iPad Pro. That's pretty complicated to get done exactly when you're just dragging a rectangle around. Mark then told me that if you start on the iPad, it's a lot easier. This is a really unintuitive interface, but you put your finger on this little circle that shows up whenever you've got AstroPad running. You press it on this little circle on the iPad app in AstroPad, and then while holding that down, use two other fingers to pinch and zoom the image and pan it around. Gotta tell you, I never would have figured that one out on my own. I set AstroPad aside, and I waited until I got my Apple Pencil. That was when the magic started to happen, and Mark started to not regret having given me this suggestion. I pulled my photo of Tesla. Remember the one we started talking about at the very beginning of her being silhouetted against the sky? I pulled that photo into Intensify CK as a plugin to Apple Photos. I launched AstroPad on both the Mac and the iPad Pro. In Intensify, I created a new layer mask just around Tesla so that I could increase the exposure and saturation on just her and maybe the ground where she was standing and yet leave the sky exposed as it already was. I told AstroPad that I had an Apple Pencil, and suddenly I was able to create the mask with incredible precision. I could go back and forth between the brush and the eraser, making smaller and smaller movements. I used my trackpad on the Mac to zoom in really close so that I could make even finer adjustments. It was a dream to do it this way. When I was happy with the exposure, I saved the changes back into Apple Photos. Next, I duplicated the image just in case I messed it up, and I used another Photos extension from MacFun called FX Photo Studio. This is a filter app, and to be perfectly honest, I'm not a huge fan of filters because they can be overused. From time to time, it can be fun, though, just as long as you exercise moderation. I found a filter called Pencil Paint, and I applied it to the now well-exposed photo, and it came out great. It looks like a colored pencil sketch, and I think it's really pretty. I may never be an artist in a traditional sense, but I think it takes a certain amount of creativity to put the pieces together and create art, so I am going to declare victory. Hey, maybe if I get an Apple keyboard for the iPad Pro, I'll be able to write a novel too. Have you ever seen those cool photos of the night sky where you can see the trails of the stars and arcs around the North Star? I love those shots, and I've always wanted to be able to get one, and this week I succeeded. I want to back up and set the stage for you about how this happened. Steve and I drove to Julian, California this week, which is out in the desert, with our good friends Diane and Bill to stay at a remarkable place called the Observer's Inn. Michael Lee built Observer's Inn as a two-room inn combined with an observatory. Two rooms, that's all there are, two rooms. This sounds crazy that this guy built his own observatory, and it kind of is, but Michael is a self-taught astronomer with research-grade telescopes and a passion for teaching people about the solar system, especially children. The inn itself is spectacular. The two bedrooms are these two giant rooms with gorgeous king-size beds and lovely quilts and private baths and, you know, all the amenities you'd really hope to have. Plus, there's a large living room area lined with bookcases filled with astronomy books. There's even a dining room table, which in our case was perfectly suited for, you know, stuff like binoculars, laptops, iPads, iPhones, chargers, cameras, and tripods. Michael even puts out a bowl of Milky Way bars for you. Get it? Milky Way? Anyway, he was very proud of his joke. He said he used to have Mars bars too, but he can't find them easily anymore, so we had to get along with Milky Ways. With the room comes a discounted price of $20 each for a one-hour astronomy lecture, and if the skies are clear, the chance to look through his telescopes at the universe. He produces a level of wonder about the stars that is absolutely infectious. For example, we got to see Andromeda, which was my favorite thing he showed us. He pointed out that something, a photon in this case, left Andromeda 2.5 million years ago and entered my body as light. Is that seriously amazing or what? I'd never thought about it that way, but it gave me chills when he said that. Next, he showed us a bottle with grains of sand in it. He asked us to look at just one grain. Then he told us to imagine holding that single grain up at arm's length over the sky. That area of the sky that you can cover with that single grain is how wide the field of view was to create the Hubble Ultra Deep Field image that was taken over the course of 4 months in 2003-2004. In that single grain of sand at arm's length field of view, they found approximately 10,000 galaxies. Just let that settle in. I mean, it's just crazy when you think of the scale of these things. And his, like I said, his excitement was infectious. I would have been happy with just the stay at the inn, and the astronomy tack was spectacular on top of that. To add to the fun, though, Diane and I decided to try and take Star Trail photos that night. If you look at a Star Trail photo, your first question might be, how long did you leave open the shutter? Because you would think you have to leave the shutter open a long time to get these beautiful arcs. It turns out leaving the shutter open for a very long time does not work because it lets in too much light so everything gets blown out. Instead, you take a series of long-ish exposure shots and blend them together into one image. To get the full circular trails, you're talking about combining hundreds, or if you're really crazy about it, thousands of images. Photographers have to take these hundreds of photos off their memory cards, import them into their computers, pull them into tools like Photoshop or other specialized applications to align, and then blend them all together. That's not what Diane and I had to do. We have the Olympus EM10 Micro Four Thirds camera, which has the ability to take this kind of photograph built in using a setting called Live Composition. Live Composition is found by setting the mode to manual. That means you have to set the aperture, the white balance, the ISO all on your own, and of course use manual focus since the camera can hardly be expected to automatically focus on infinity. Once you're in manual mode, you start to turn the shutter speed dial down and down and down, increasing the exposure time as you go. Once you get really, really long, it finally goes, do you really want bulb mode? And that's a mode that many cameras have that allow you to press the shutter once to open and a second time when you want it to close. But you're not done yet. Another dial down and you get to live time. This is a very cool feature I think I've talked about before and I enjoy it on the camera. It's like bulb, but it lets you view on the display how the image is exposing so you know when to tell it to stop. Finally, one more click of the dial and you'll see live composition. As you'll learn as I go through this, having this setting built in is really powerful, but you still have a lot of decisions to make to get it to come out the way you want it to look. So it's automatic, and I'm putting automatic in air quotes here, but an awful lot you have to do on your own. When you dial into live composition, it tells you to set the exposure time. This might sound confusing, but you need to tell it how long each of the zillion photos you're going to take will be exposed. I found a great blog post over at atmtxphoto.com where the author, Andy, explained how he chose his settings for his Star Trail photo with the EM10. His photos are extraordinary, so I decided let's use his settings as a baseline. Andy used a 20-second exposure, and he set his ISO to 800. The ISO is going to control how much light gets to the sensor during that 20 seconds, and he explained that 800 was about as high as you could comfortably push the EM10 without introducing a lot of noise. But there's more than taking a photo than just setting these dials to the right number. Victor Cahiao had a great interview with Nick Page on his TerraTech podcast over at terratech.tech, where Nick explained a lot about how to take great photos of the stars. Nick talked about the composition of the photo and how a photo of just stars can be pretty boring. He suggested getting something in the foreground, like a structure or a tree, to help give it context. He talked about light painting of the tree with a flashlight and suggested doing it from the sides to get a more interesting effect. So, I've got Nick and Andy's advice working here, but we can't forget all of the work Bart did teaching us about taking photos of the night sky. He talked about setting your white balance specifically when he talked about shooting the moon. He said all of the light of the moon is actually reflected from the sun, so you want to set the white balance to sunny. And all by myself, I extrapolated that since the sun is a star, and we're taking photos of stars, we should set our white balance to the sunny day setting. Last piece of the puzzle was our shiny new matching, but mine in red, Diane's in black, $60 Manfrotto compact tripods. Okay, I lied. We had one more thing. Steve bought me a little red flashlight, especially for night photography and stargazing. And not just so that I wouldn't fall down walking around in the dark, though it did work very well for that, but he got me one with a red filter on Bart's recommendation so that we wouldn't have trouble adjusting our eyes from, you know, looking at a bright white light. We set up our cameras pointing about 90 degrees from the North Star on the advice of our astronomer, Michael. Not because showing the stars rotating around the North Star wouldn't be awesome, but because we didn't want to stand around in the cold waiting as long as the close-in stars would take to make good arcing trails. You can get the far ones out at the edges. That's a lot easier. They go farther, right? The M10's live composition mode has basically three steps to it. Once you've told it how long to have the shutter open, in our case 20 seconds, you push the shutter release once. It takes a 20-second baseline photo. From that photo, it measures the light in the scene. This is a critical part of the process because the camera is only going to record what light has changed from this original image. I have no clue how this little camera figures that out, but it's the magic sauce behind live composition. Once you have that baseline photo, the camera tells you to hit the shutter release again. In the viewfinder, it's going to show you a live view of the image being created, and it shows you a counter. You can see the number of shots it's taken and a counter showing the 20 seconds counting by. I love having the live view because you can tell if you've botched something up before wasting all that time waiting to see how it comes out. I am so spoiled. Remember film and waiting days to get it back? Now I can't afford to wait minutes anymore. Partway through the exposures, Diane and I took our little red flashlights and, like Nick suggested, we light painted the tree from opposite sides for about the length of one exposure. Remember, the camera is taking into account what's changed so that one exposure of red light worked perfectly. When the photo looked good to me on the viewfinder, I hit the shutter release one final time to tell it to stop. My only regret was I really wish I'd been alert enough to remember to look at the display the final time before I hit the shutter, but I forgot, so I can only estimate how many images it took. It would have told me if I'd looked at it. I think it was around 20 minutes, and with 20-second exposures, that would mean I took about 60 images. When you tell it to stop, it takes it about a minute to combine all the photos together. Now think about how much math that little processor in the EM10 is doing. If I had to take 60 photos from my memory card, drag them into my photo app, stack them up into layers and on top of layers, align them, and then merge them down, that would take me at least a half an hour, even if it was a push button within the app. How does it do it in 1 minute? Again, the secret sauce. I put the image I got from all of this in the blog post, along with a link to a full-size version, so you can see how cool it came out. I should explain that you'll see some diagonal dotted lines across the star trails. Those are actually aircraft going by, which was unexpected but kind of cool. I really want to go back onto the wilderness and try this again because it was so much fun. I live in the city, so if I did it here, I'd get like 4 trails and a lot of light pollution. Maybe I should do it just for the comedy. Or maybe I'll try it next with fireworks on the 4th of July. I've tried to take long exposure shots from my daughter's backyard, but if I leave the shutter open long enough to get a good light trail, the fence and the trees in the backyard get lit up by ambient light. With live composition, I could do a bunch of shorter exposures, make the camera do the heavy lifting. I still cannot believe that a $500 camera can do all of this. Well, we're halfway through November and the gift-giving season is upon us. If you're looking for that very special Festivus gift, you'll probably wait till the last minute and need to have free Prime shipping on Amazon. So why not use the Amazon affiliate link for the show? If you do, it sends a few percent back to help us keep the lights on here, and I'd really appreciate it. Simply click on the big fat Amazon image on the left sidebar, and everything you buy during that session will go to help the show while not costing you a penny more. Well, it's that time of the fortnight. It's time for security with Bart Bouchatz. We can't call it security light today because we're starting with security medium. How are you doing today, Bart?
Apart from the cold weather making me cranky, I'm doing okay.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, I'm really glad about your first topic because I would really like to understand this because it's still plaguing me. So I'm looking forward to hearing your interpretation.
Okay, so we may as well get stuck in then. So security medium number one is what really happened with the Mac App Store? Because people, I think pretty much everyone has suffered from this to some extent, where apps that were working just fine last week, all of a sudden this week started to not work. Either saying, please enter your password again, or saying, this app doesn't pass validation, it's broken, corrupted, please download it again.
Yeah, two very different symptoms, right?
Two different symptoms because they actually had two different causes.
Ah.
So it's one of these cases where, in hindsight, it's all very simple because there were two things wrong at the same time, but at the time, it made it all very, very, very confusing because there were two things wrong at the same time.
Ah.
So let's start with what happened. Actually, no, let's start a little before that. So one of the advantages that Apple gives us to keep us more secure is this concept of code signing. So that means if an app has been tampered with since the developer finished it, ROS will refuse to run it. And that means that gives you protection from having Trojanized versions of real apps, which is something which we know happens a lot.
That's why we like code signing.
That's why we like code signing. But code signing obviously involves certificates and various bits and bobs to make that actually go.
Okay.
And that means that there are a bunch of certificates that Apple create and that our Macs contain. And we use those certificates to validate the signatures on the apps. And one of those certificates was due to run out this week. And it was a SHA-1 certificate. So that was the protocol it used, SHA-1. Secure Hashing Algorithm 1, if you're wondering what that stands for. And that cert was due to expire. And contrary to a lot of reporting, Apple were not caught unawares. Apple created a new cert. Okay. And that new cert was issued now. And therefore, Apple issued it with what's actually very sensible, SHA-2. The newer version of the SHA algorithm, which is more secure and is really best practice these days. So SHA-1
should be... It's been around for a while, right? SHA-2?
Oh, yeah. SHA-2, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So Apple did the very sensible thing of issuing the new cert with SHA-2 instead of SHA-1. Now, this is where the first of two problems occurred. So there is a bug, which Apple now realize and are now going to patch, which causes the App Store app on the Mac to be a little bit too zealous in caching certificates. So what happened was that the Mac Store app cached the certificate even after it had expired.
And in the, by caching it, we mean it's saving the old certificate, right?
Yeah, so rather than going and asking Apple, give me the current signing cert, it just says, yeah, I'll use what I have on file. Even though what it had on file had expired and there was a new one sitting on Apple servers just waiting to be downloaded, the caching algorithm had a mistake in it and it didn't check to see, have I expired? If I have expired, invalidate the cache and go fetch a fresh copy. So that's why rebooting fixed an awful, awful lot of problems, because rebooting flushed this cache.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
So that's the first problem, and that got a lot of people out of a lot of situations. But that then left a handful of apps that were still not behaving, and that's the second problem.
So did, with that problem, did logging out and logging back in fix it? Or is that the second problem?
I don't know. It may be that logging out and logging back in was enough to clear the cache. I don't know. Apple's support document said to reboot.
Okay.
But I can't tell you for sure whether or not the cache is cleared just by logging out and logging back in. The second problem then is that there were apps, once the App Store had the correct cert, this new SHA-2 cert, then there were still apps that said they were corrupt, which is the second error message we were getting. And those corrupt apps, they weren't really corrupt, but the problem is the app an app that's in the App Store validates itself to make sure that it has been paid for and is not pirated. And the apps contain cryptographic algorithms to do that. And no one reinvents the wheel. So the chances are that these developers got some sort of common code from somewhere to do this validation. And that common code was using a very old version of OpenSSL, which does not support SHA-2. So any app with this old validation code baked into it could not deal with this new certificate that Apple had issued.
Does that mean they had code validation software from, how far back did you say SHA-2 came out? Like 2005 or something?
SHA-2 is old, yeah. So, not necessarily that it's that old. It could just be a case that for optimization reasons that it was compiled without the options to do these certs that Apple wasn't using then. So there are, you don't want to have the whole of the OpenSSL library baked into your app when all you need is SHA-1. So that's another potentially sane explanation. It's not that it's old versions of OpenSSL, but that it's cut down versions of OpenSSL.
Hmm. Okay.
By the way, they did not have support for SHA-2. Therefore, they had the apps.
Okay.
So those apps were not able to validate themselves because they had no idea what a SHA-2 hash was. It was garbage. Therefore, they called themselves corrupt. They couldn't validate themselves as being okay.
Okay. So, would you be looking down your frowny nose at these companies?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
But the chances are it's not the companies directly. So the chances, realistically, it's probably a case that people buy this in third party. So every app developer isn't going to reinvent the wheel. So the chances are there's some sort of library out there that lots of them use. And whoever wrote that library wasn't thinking ahead far enough. So it's kind of a facepalm. And the problem is these certificates all are set to last for like 10, 15 years. I think this one now expires in 2025 or something ridiculous like that. So the problem is this is something that doesn't happen often. And things that don't happen often have a habit of going wrong. How many opportunities have we had to practice this procedure? Zero until now. So now we're going to learn lessons that we're not going to need again until 2025. What are the chances we'll have forgotten?
Well, if you document it and clarify, you'd be able to go back and find out, right?
Right. So it's, yeah. Now, Apple were then left in a situation. Do we force all developers to update their apps so they can deal with SHA-2, or do we just accept that for now we should go back to SHA-1? And Apple decided to reissue a new SHA-1 cert. And they can now, in a controlled fashion, say, by the way, guys, this new SHA-1 cert, we're going to pull it in a year or two. So you need to have your apps updated by X date. So, you know, Apple now have the power to switch over from SHA-1 to SHA-2 at their leisure. But they solve the immediate problem by reissuing a new SHA-1 cert.
So I'm still getting those corrupted app things, like yesterday.
Yeah, once an app has been marked as corrupted, it seems that the only way to get it uncorrupted is to reinstall it.
Even though they said you could reboot to fix that, right?
Well, the reboot, you see, gets the App Store cache right, but once an app is marked as having failed validation, it seems to stay that way.
Okay.
So you're right, even after all, the apps that have the second problem, that symptom isn't easily fixable, apart from re-downloading is the only thing that's worked for me.
Huh.
Which includes 1Password and a few others.
Our audio program, what's it called? Amadeus Pro. That's the one that keeps failing for me.
Aha, okay, well that should now work once you reinstall from the App Store.
Right. Actually, that was the first one I reinstalled. The very first one I saw it on, I was like, what? What is this janky software?
If you reinstalled it too early, you reinstalled it before the new SHA-1 cert came out, then back to where you were before.
Yeah. That's probably it. Because, yeah, it was the first one. I did it immediately. It was before anything came out about this.
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a mess. But at this stage of the game, rebooting should get you out of the normal problems, and then the other problems can be solved by redownloading the apps that are still failing. It's not pleasant, but there we go.
Great. I understand it was really fun to be a developer.
Oh, I'm sure their support lines were not happy.
And they're going like, what? We don't know.
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course. No one really knew what was going on. Yeah, so Apple issued an apology, and none of this is going to happen again. Or none of this is even going to potentially happen again for quite some time, because the new certs are valid till 2025 or so.
Okay, we'll have some other problem by then.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the second security medium topic is somewhat difficult one to talk about, but the title I've given it is Paris Doesn't Change Mathematics, because it doesn't. Okay. So there's a maxim in politics that you should never let a good crisis go to waste. And I'm afraid to say there's an awful lot of people trying to do that at the moment. And no matter how angry we are, and no matter how sad we are by what's happened, maths is still maths, and it hasn't changed. And so all of us want to do something to stop this happening again. And no one is in favor of it happening again, but we shouldn't make things worse for ourselves because it feels good in the short term, because we think we're doing something good when we're actually just making everything worse for ourselves. It's the old, don't cut off your nose to spite your face. You might make it feel good for a moment, but then you realize you've just cut off your nose to spite your face. So the key points are that any government-mandated backdoor is a backdoor, and it is impossible cryptographically to create a secure backdoor. If you're making a backdoor, you're making a backdoor, which means that, yes, our quote-unquote, our governments can use that backdoor, quote-unquote, legitimately to watch what's going on the internet. So can all the cyber criminals in the world, and perhaps even more worryingly, so can foreign governments. So can all those governments we really don't like very much. So if you weaken crypto, you've weakened crypto. All of it. You can't have mostly secure crypto. It's either secure crypto or it's insecure crypto. So that's why the idea in the UK is just such a disastrously terrible idea. It was before Paris and it still is after Paris.
So this is specifically to do with opening a back door, or is it also to do with having full encryption, say like in iMessage or whatever they've chosen to call it today?
Well, iMessage, the thing, if you have encryption, you have encryption. So either you have encryption or you don't. What the government want is to have half encryption. Yes. You can be safe from the bad guys, but we still get to see what you're doing. Well, that's just not how reality works. Mm-mm. That is a unicorn. That is not possible. And that's what cryptographers have been saying over and over again for years now, but politicians don't like to listen. They assume that everyone in Silicon Valley can do magic and that reality doesn't matter. If we say so, you'll just do it. It's like, yep, it can't be done. Don't ask us to do the impossible.
So it seems to me that if for part of this is they're telling people like Apple that you should make a backdoor into your phones. Well, okay, if there's a backdoor into the phones, but encrypted traffic is still possible, then all you've done is made our phones accessible by creepy governments. And right. The bad guys can still do encryption. We can still do encryption. So you haven't solved anything at all.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, the other thing then, so let's imagine we live in a world where Cameron gets his way, and once Cameron gets his way, then I'm sure the US would follow suit, the Chinese would follow instantly. We're living in a world now where we have weak crypto and there are backdoors. Well, if you're a bad guy who wants to communicate securely over those channels that you know have been compromised, what do? You just add your own layer of encryption before it goes into the service. So then you've still completely blocked out the governments from viewing the stuff.
Right.
You know, so if you put an encrypted disk image in Dropbox and Dropbox hand everything over to the feds, oh, look, they've just handed over an encrypted disk image. Nothing is achieved. If you encrypt your message, then send it through iMessage, no matter how compromised iMessage is, your message is still encrypted because you encrypted it yourself before you sent it. So even the most vile backdoor doesn't achieve anything in terms of tracking actual terrorist activity. Because of point three, the math for crypto is known. The genie cannot go back into the bottle. Mm-hmm. All you can do is make everyone except for the terrorists insecure. Or you can let us be secure and the terrorists be secure, but the terrorists are going to be secure. The math is known. It cannot be unknown. We can't go back to not knowing how to make an atomic bomb. We can't go back to not knowing how to encrypt. It can't be done.
So why... I mean, these people aren't categorically across the board stupid, are they?
But they're technologically illiterate.
Okay, but they're getting advised, obviously, by... Didn't something break yesterday, the day before, the super-duper encryption society of the globe said, hey, morons, this can't work?
Yes, but they're also being advised by security agencies who don't really care that they insecure everyone else because they are voracious for data. So what's happening is an unhonest debate. You're being told, I know Silicon Valley says it's not possible, but it is, by people who have a vested interest. They, like the NSA and the CIA, they really want that data. And they don't care about the collateral damage.
Hmm.
So, and frankly...
Do you really? Is that fair to say? I mean...
My opinion. I can't prove that.
Yeah.
I also think it's my opinion that Cameron wants a police state.
Great.
He really, really, really can't grok the idea that there is something happening that he can't see. He doesn't accept that. Of course, you have the other point that all of this stuff can be got through normal means, right? If I'm communicating with you and you have you take over my endpoint, well, then you can see everything I'm sending anyway because the encryption is happening while it's being sent. So you have the whole point that a lot of this stuff is pointless anyway because you just catch the data at the other end of the transit and stuff. So anyway, don't take my word for any of this because I'm just a guy on the internet. So I have a whole batter of lists in the show notes to people much wiser than me explaining it from different points of view. So I would say if you're interested in this, and I think everyone should be given how important a topic this is, particularly in the UK where this is going, the UK is going to be the first battlefield on this. And it's going to be very contentious debate. Hopefully. And it's going to be a very hard one to win.
Really? You don't think they're going to win?
No, as in I think that the wrong thing is going to be done out of pure emotion. I think we're looking at Patriot Act Mark II, only with a UK accent. Because emotion is very strong here in Europe. And emotion is blinding us.
It's been suggested that it would be an interesting move if Apple were to say, you know what, we just aren't going to sell you our phones.
They can do that if it's just the UK, but what if the US government follows suit and the Chinese government follows suit? It very quickly becomes an untenable position.
Yeah. But if the UK goes first...
And then Apple follow through. It all depends on the momentum. It all depends on who blinks first.
Yeah.
Now, it's certainly not one I'd gamble on.
Or if Google and Apple did it together.
Or you could do something where you'd have some sort of giant red mark appearing on every message that's being sent to the UK or something.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, the sort of the passive-aggressive approach.
Yeah, here we complied. Apple knows how to do that.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of different ways this can all pan out. We're certainly in for some interesting times.
All right.
So, on that cheery topic.
Yeah. Thanks, Bert. Nice having you.
I think it's appropriate to throw in a Vive la France at the end of that. Because, well, particularly actually with my Belgian connections, I've been, the feckin' Belgians going around doing all this kind of stuff in France. It makes me very cranky.
Hey, how about this one? We'll end with this. Did you see the Russians are writing for Paris on their bombs that they're dropping on ISIS?
What kind of a weird... Yeah, I know.
I think that's just so awesome. That is my favorite thing. Steve posted that in Reddit, and it made it to number two in all of Reddit.
Ooh, nicely done.
So it was quite appreciated by people.
And there is also the fact that it's looking quite likely that everyone who is bombing Syria may actually agree to work together, which might be useful.
Yeah, it's a horrible way for that to have happened, but I would really like to see that.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so there we go. We found a silver lining-ish. Yeah. We found something that's not utterly depressing to move on to Security Light.
Sick to your stomach. Yes, Security Light. Yay. Patch Tuesday. Woohoo.
Yes, so Patch Tuesday has been and gone. We have had updates to Windows, Internet Explorer, Skype, and Flash from Microsoft and Adobe, and also an update to Office for Mac from Microsoft.
Hmm.
So patchy, patchy.
All right, and that's the old Office and new Office? 14?
So it must be 2014.
I think that's the newer one. Okay.
Yes. Okay, sorry. I should go back to my own show notes. Okay. So, important security news. Quite a bit to chunk through here. So, there is a new variant of Android malware that can install itself, even when the user explicitly denies the app permission to install. So, if after everything I've said over the last, like, year, you're still going around using unofficial Android app stores, no, seriously, stop. This is getting really, really ick. Like, last time we talked about stuff that was almost impossible to get back out if you get infected with it, and now we have a way of getting in even when you say no. Put those two together, it's just not good.
Yikes. Backing up for real quick, I just checked. Update 14.5.8 is for the, it's coming into Excel 2011 right now. So it is the older one possibly as well.
Okay, that is 2011, I think, is the one I actually have. And it did indeed ask me to update itself when I went to check a spreadsheet. So yes.
Okay.
Okay. Facebook's real name policy just can't get a break. So we said nice things about them last time, and now they've gone and got it wrong again. In an attempt to no doubt do good, they have banned anyone with the very common first name of Isis.
Oh.
Because Isis is an Egyptian god, and it's a common first name.
Yeah, for
women. Unfortunately, it's also one of many acronyms for, well, Isis, or Daesh, or ISIL, or whatever we're calling them this week. So Facebook, obviously the algorithm wasn't quite right, and there was one particular lady got this some prominence because she kind of had to send them their passport 3 or 4 times until they actually paid attention, and that's just wrong. You know, when you ban someone because you're not sure it's the real name and they send you their passport, that should kind of be that. There shouldn't be any more of it. So anyway. Belgium also ordered Facebook to stop tracking users who are not logged in. Or face a fine of €250,000 a day.
They were tracking users who are not logged in. How the heck do you do that?
With a cookie.
Oh.
So you click the log out button, you just don't clear one of your two cookies.
Nice.
Yes, charming, isn't it? Now, Facebook actually said that it was for security reasons that they need to track you all over the internet, and that if Belgium made them stop, it would, quote, turn Belgium... That cookie is preventing Belgium from becoming a den of cyber terrorism, which I thought was charming. So as Naked Security put it, it's some type of prophylactic InfoSec wonder cookie. Facebook are appealing. We shall see where it goes.
Oh, God.
Good news, Amazon is bringing two-factor auth.
I heard that.
Yes, which is particularly important, actually, if you're using stuff... You know, if you have your website hosted on Amazon's cloud services and stuff, I think two-factor auth would be extra uber important so that your whole company can't be hacked so easily.
Yeah, I do find that there's an odd problem with two-factor authentication. So I have it for my website. That is actually mm-hmm. the only thing I have two-factor authentication on. So I try to log into my website and it doesn't let me, and it says, okay, I'm going to send you a text message. Where do you think that text message goes, Bart? To all my devices. Imagine. So
yeah, so maybe. Well, it still means okay, but someone attacking your website is unlikely to have your devices. If they already have your devices, you have a bigger problem.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought that was kind of interesting when I saw it come up right in front. Like, I don't have to go get my phone because it's going to come up right on my.
It's still something you have as your phone.
But it's coming up on the the laptop as well. But yeah, you're right. You're right. That's a way to think about it. I feel better.
Yeah, so you got to have your own devices and have the password. So a bad guy may guess the password, but it's unlikely they also have your own any of your devices. So it's still. It still adds great value.
Okay, good. I feel better.
We also have a new shiny named vulnerability, because shiny named vulnerabilities are ones that get media attention. So bad barcode. Follow on from bad bias, I guess. Mm-hmm. So this is, okay, step one, don't set hair on fire. So Chinese security researchers have demonstrated that a whole bunch of barcode readers and apps that read barcodes are badly written. They basically assume that the barcode contains only what the barcode is supposed to contain. And whenever you make an assumption like that, you pretty much introduce a security vulnerability. You should always validate your data when it's coming from an outside source. And if the apps did, this wouldn't be a problem. So what's basically happening is a lot of apps treat barcodes as keyboards. So the way that the barcode gets into the app is that it's just treated as a keyboard input and it's just read from as a keyboard. And you can encode into the barcode control C, control V, and all those kind of control characters, which the app may then blindly execute and do silly things. So just validate your data and all will be well. So for you and I and regular end users, nothing to do here. For people who make barcodes, barcode readers, or apps that use barcode readers, they need to make sure their code is correctly validating the barcode. And that's the end of that.
Okay.
Apple and Google both had to pull an app from their respective app stores because that app turned out to be stealing Instagram passwords. So the app is called InstaAgent, and it asked users to log into Instagram to check the status of their account or something silly.
No,
and it was doing that, and it was taking a copy of the password while it was at it.
I believe the purpose of the app was to allow you to see who was following you on Instagram. That was its stated purpose.
Yes, and I'm sure it did that, but it also took a copy of your password and sent it back home, phoned home with it. Yes.
It's getting a little hard to be snarky about Google when Apple has these problems too, right?
Yes, because no system is perfect, because Apple is making a human look at every app before putting it into the store. Google have also decided to make a human look at every app because they've actually copied Apple. But, you know, having a human look at every app is better than just blindly accepting apps, but it's still
doesn't
imperfect.
Make it an, doesn't mean you picked an infallible human.
Right, because I've yet to find one of those. And any sort of automated code scanning, the only way to check every possible permutation is to basically take the entire length of the universe to check one app. It's also not practical. So you're basically into the whole thing problem if you're going to get TCS about it. So there are going to be issues. The question is, how do these companies respond when there are? And the more they can filter out up front, the better. So yeah, the app store isn't perfect. I don't think anyone ever said it was, though.
I wanted it to be, though.
Ah, we all do. Of course we do. A very disturbing story from the world of Google. So the Gmail app on Android has a bug in it in how it parses, interprets the from name in email addresses. And that bug allows any malicious senders to people who use this app to fake the from address in such a way that it bypasses almost all of the email spoofing detection features. In fact, it bypasses all the ones that exist in Google. And this was reported to Google, who decided to reply by saying that they don't think it's a security issue. So being able to send an email as anyone on the planet and have the Gmail app. Yeah, I know. How is this not a security issue? I'm very cranky at Google for this. So what I would say is, if you use Android and you use the Gmail app, be very suspicious of every email. The from address, the from field cannot be trusted. It is broken.
Wait a minute. If it's the app that'll allow you to create these fake addresses.
No. It's the app that this.
It's the receiving
anyone
app?
Anyone can create it. Yeah, anyone can create a misformed from. You basically have to put in two quotation marks instead of one, and it completely messes up the app's interpretation of the address.
So it's the way the app interprets it as it receives it that it doesn't catch it. Okay, not the creator. So, okay.
Yes. So the creator is someone who knows that this bug exists in the Gmail app, and you send out emails in the hope that, you know, basically anyone who's using this app will be much easier to fool than everyone else on the planet. So it's this very simple thing for spammers to do for phishing attacks and so forth. Just use this now known problem, and then you know that everyone looking at your email in an Android Gmail app is going to see the wrong from, which makes it much easier to defraud people. It's a terrible thing. I hope Google sees sense very quickly. Also from the school of not understanding the problem, we have an example. And this is more of a case of, this is not really a story about Chipotle. This is just Chipotle doing something which I'm sure other people are doing too. And this is a perfect opportunity to say to everyone, this is a bad idea. So what Chipotle are doing is, if you apply for a job with them, you get an automated email, but that email comes with a from address that doesn't exist. It's from a domain name that they don't own. This is just a configuration issue in their, you know, customer CRM, customer relations management app.
Okay. Right?
But what that means is that anyone on the planet can register that domain, and they will then receive all the emails mistakenly sent. So the email says, don't reply to this email, but you know what humanity is like. Of course they reply.
Right.
So if you register the domain, all those emails come to you, and you are then free to reply back to them, and they think you're Chipotle. Hey, presto, phishing set up.
Holy cow. Right?
And Chipotle have made that possible by using a from address they do not own. Just don't do that.
So why haven't they just fixed that?
Because they, quote, think
Google,
this is
Google told them
issue.
It wasn't a security problem?
Right. I don't know who told them, but whatever it is, the Chipotle people are like, what? This isn't a problem. Okay, fine. We'll change it if you insist. But really, there's no problem here. Ugh. And then the security world is going, no, you idiots. There is.
Wow.
So just to say, if you need to have a reply to address that's fictitious, don't actually use noreply@example.com. Use noreply at a domain you actually own. This has happened before. I think someone registered noemail.com and then started getting like hundreds and hundreds of replies a day from people, because just never, ever, ever have a reply to address you don't own, period. Okay, so security researchers have found that Conficker is on a bunch of police body cams, and this is just disturbing in a whole bunch of ways, because the
remind
whole point of these
Conficker
body cams
was? I know the name, but I don't remember what it was.
It's a worm that is probably going to be on the internet forever.
Oh, okay.
Just get used to it. Its way into so many things, yeah. But it shouldn't be on these cams. And the fact that it's on these body cams is worrying, because the whole point of these body cams is it's supposed to introduce some, not transparency, what's the word? Sugar. I can't remember the word. Accountability, thank you. That is the one I was looking for. Some accountability into policing, because there have been issues with that. Mm-hmm. And so this is just not good news. And I'm hoping that police departments respond appropriately and take appropriate action. Just in case you didn't, you still don't take our word and update all software all the time, there is now a new variant of ransomware that wanders around the internet looking for vulnerabilities in your website. So let's say you have a WordPress you haven't kept up to date, or a plugin you haven't kept up to date. So it finds a way into your website and then encrypts your website and then sends you a ransom note saying, if you don't pay me blah amount of Bitcoin, you're never getting your website back. It's not surprising it's come to this, but just saying. So again,
I'm not going to invite you on the show anymore. It's getting depressing.
I'm sorry. Speaking of depressing, in case you thought that smart TVs were a good idea, which I've always said is a terrible idea, people who don't know anything about software writing software, buy a little plug-in box into your television and let your television just be television. Anyway, Vizio is apparently a popular provider of smart TVs. And Vizio have decided that by default, what they will do is they will watch everything you do and report back to Vizio HQ, tying the information of what you're viewing to your IP address and then selling the combination of what you're watching and what your IP address is to advertisers. So they can then advertise at you online based on what you're doing on your television.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's vile.
Oh.
And the reason they can do this is because there are laws in America outlawing this kind of behavior, but those laws are written in such a way that they can be interpreted to only apply to cable providers and other normal traditional sources of content, not the bloody television you're watching it on. So a loophole they have discovered. Yeah. So I would say buy a TV that's dumb and then buy a box from a company you trust to plug into your dumb TV to give it some smarts.
Well, the nice thing is if the $35 Chromecast does this, you throw that away, not your $2,000 TV.
Exactly. And then you pick up a Fire Stick if you're, I don't know why you do that, but you could. Or you pick up an Apple TV or whatever. I mean, there's much cooler products out there. Also, your TV is going to last longer than any of the digital brains that they could hard code into it. So we've already had a situation where a whole bunch of smart TVs lost YouTube ability when YouTube changed their APIs. TVs last 5-10 years. Software really goes off very quickly. So smart TVs are just a bad design.
Never saw the attraction.
Neither did I. I just thought this was a problem.
At least the interface is usually bad.
Oh, God, yes. TV interfaces. They don't know what they're doing in software. Anyway, Microsoft have announced that beginning in mid-2016, their non-US customers will have the choice to have their data stored in Germany. So this is...
Wait, for that's us good European. News.
Oh, brilliant news. Absolutely. I'm delighted by this. I hope Google are listening. And I hope Google are in a copying mood.
What about Apple?
I hope Apple are listening too, actually. I hope an awful lot of people are listening.
I was going to say, you just didn't even hope Apple would.
Right, actually, yeah. So we'll have drop. Well, actually, Apple are building a giant big data center in Ireland. So, hello, Apple.
Hi. Over here.
Yeah, so this is a great idea. And I like this idea that our cloud data is going to become a little bit more localized so that instead of having the worst of all laws, everyone gets to be protected by their own laws, which is
so
good.
So only
because,
the baddest law locally.
Yeah, but that's good because that now gives you the ability to talk to your, you know, your elected representatives and get your law fixed. Whereas there the problem we have in Europe is if we talk to our representatives and we say what kind of stuff we'd like to have in our data, they say, yeah, that's fine, but it's not here.
Right, right. Can I have my data stored in Germany?
I do not believe so because I think there may be things that Microsoft USA has to do stuff in the USA because we don't deal with Microsoft USA, we deal with Microsoft Europe.
Mm. Okay. That was a joke, actually, but not totally.
It'd be interesting if they offered some sort of product, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Maybe you need to set up like a European subsidiary of Podfeet.
There you go. Well, I'm meeting with Klaus Wolf tomorrow. We'll discuss that.
There you go. And finally, another bit of good news. So the US FCC, Federal Communications Commission, isn't it? FCC? Yes.
Yes.
The FCC have revised a recent rule change that caused some consternation. Initially... So what they were trying to do was say that you have to protect the firmware on routers so that they can't be made to broadcast in the wrong frequency or at the wrong intensity. Basically, you should have protections in place to protect the radio spectrum. But they had worded it in such a way that it sounded like they were making manufacturers prevent reflashing of the OS. Basically, like it looked like they were trying to make DDWRT illegal.
Right, right, right.
And so the FCC have said, our bad, we worded it wrong. Here's the new wording. You are perfectly in your rights to reflash the OS, but not make the radio transmit in frequencies that are not allowed. Which is fine. That's perfectly fine. So what it now says is that your firmware cannot be updated so that it makes the radio, quote, out of its RF frequency compliance. Fine.
That's all they really wanted, right? So that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's a case of the smart people on the internet getting together and saying, no, that's not what you mean, right? And helping them.
Yeah, and them going, oh, no, you're right. That's not what we mean. Ta-da! Yeah, so this is good. This is how things should work. Now, this is under the notable breaches section, but it's not really a breach. So Comcast have had to reset 200,000 passwords because they appeared for sale on the dark web. But they didn't appear for sale on the dark web because Comcast had been hacked. They appeared on the dark web because it's almost certainly a cache of passwords from other breaches that were reused on Comcast.
Oh.
So while we say, this is why you shouldn't reuse passwords, this is why you shouldn't reuse passwords. Just to underscore that point.
Hmm.
Suggested reading. Again, I'm only going to mention these and you should read at your own leisure. So there is a timely reminder to parents to keep an eye on what's on your kid's smartphone. This is a very troubling story about a sexting scandal in a school. There is a timely reminder from Intego's Mac Security blog about why you should set up medical ID on your iPhone. I think you should, by the way. There's a really good PSA from Macworld basically saying never, ever, ever download software from software download sites. They're all rotten these days.
All of them.
Yeah. There is an interesting sort of avoid phishing by example story from Naked Security, where they basically have three real world examples of the three most common types of phishing email. And they sort of go through them and show you what to look out for and how basically they arm you with the knowledge not to get, hopefully to avoid getting phished. And then the last one I'm going to draw attention to is that there was a kerfuffle. That's probably the best word between Tor Carnegie Mellon University and the FBI. I couldn't possibly summarize. There are about five links in the show notes to this developing story. If you cared, there it is. And there's a whole bunch more in suggested reading, but that's all I'll draw attention to.
I would like to point out that the links he gives have the, they did it. No, I didn't. Yeah, I did. Yeah, they did it. Why does it matter? And why that's it does matter, I should say.
It's okay. A he said, she said, and then a piece from Ars Technica saying why it matters.
Yep.
Okay, well, that is our security news. So, what was my new catchphrase?
This is terrible. You had something. Safe computing, happy bee.
somehow I don't think that was it. Stay patched and stay secure.
There you go. Try it again with emphasis now.
Okay, until next time, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Be sure to check out that new Silicast Google Plus community I'm talking all about. I love you guys. Anyway, we're having lots of fun over there. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Richard from Alaska came back again. Can't believe it. I don't know why people come back twice. Must be all the fun in there. Anyway, if you want to join in the fun of the live show like Richard, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Normally Sunday, this week it was on Monday, and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.